Good evening. James McCanny here with my Science Hour, going right into the show this evening. And, let me adjust something here in my studio. Okay, that's a little better. Adjust the sound on my end. June 24th, 2010, James McCanny going right into the Science Hour. And tonight, the main science topic will be, what if you could look or see in X-rays? What would the world look like? What would the universe look like? What would our solar system look like? And what would a comet look like? Things like that. So what would Saturn look like? What would Jupiter look like? So put on your X-ray 3D glasses. This is not the Toy Story. This will be the space version of Toy Story. What's that movie that's out now? Sorry, I don't know the name of that movie, but it's very popular, new 3D movie. But anyway, tonight we'll do the X-ray version of the world. And what would the world look like in X-rays? But that leads to some very interesting questions, for example, dealing with the so-called dark matter, Big Bang, string theory, or now brain theory. It's getting more bizarre all the time. But what I want to do is bring everybody back to reality and actually tell you that the universe is a pretty normal place if you understand how it really works from the electrical perspective. So I'll be talking about that as the main science topic. First, a few quick announcements. First of all, my web sales page has been upgraded. Now, if you would realize that a lot of people criticize me for my web page, and it is really not the best one on the planet or even in the universe, and I'll be the first to admit it. But I do most of these things that you see, I do them myself so that I know exactly what is going there. I've made attempts in the past to have other people work on the web page or try and do fancy things with it, and typically those efforts have ended up in somewhat of a disaster, and I've had to go back and undo many things, and at any rate, it's just been difficult to find the proper combination of efforts to upgrade the web page. However, the sales web page, the part where you go to purchase things, I've taken all of the sales buttons and put them all up at the top with much easier instructions. So for those people that want to purchase something, they can just go quickly purchase them. At the top of the page, all the buttons are very nicely organized. And then for people that want more information, a lot more detail, that don't know that much about, say, Dalton water filters, or the Flax products, or whatever, the books, DVDs, etc., that are there, they can go down and read all the details, and the order buttons are down below with the descriptions also to make it easy for people to order that are reading all of the details. But if you already know what you want, just go to the top of the page, the buttons are right there, and within minutes, you'll be done and out of there. So, that's a little bit of an upgrade. Regarding the weather this week, we had, of course, last week, the storm systems that moved through the upper Midwest, and I talked about those in detail. I talked about the storm systems over the past couple weeks. We had some severe storms in the upper Midwest and then also in the southeast United States, from about Texas to the east coast, and then from Kentucky on down to Florida. But at the time, there were some rapidly changing solar wind fluctuations. That's the wind of charged particles that races by the Earth every day, every hour, every second of our existence, and a tremendous amount of energy in that solar wind. But that, if it's at a constant rate, then Earth has self-governing mechanisms, a magnetic field. We have a protective magnetic field and sheath which surrounds Earth and protects us. But when that solar wind rapidly changes, all of those protective mechanisms change and adjust, and that ripples down all the way to the surface of the Earth and can trigger tornadoes, hurricanes, other foul weather, which it did a couple weeks ago. We had some severe storm activity in the Atlantic, but none of it developed into a hurricane for a hurricane to develop, you need some extra energy, so to speak. You need some serious energy coming in from outer space. And as I announced on one of my shows, it was about probably at least a month ago, I said that this Atlantic hurricane season would be pretty much a nothing. And so far it's been that way. There's a storm that's, it's not really a storm, it's a low pressure cell just a little bit southeast of Cuba that has been kind of sitting there migrating its way into the east of Nicaragua. And, but nothing, no storm activity, no eyes, no serious storm development, just thunderstorms in that system at this point. So basically so far, up to this point in time, not a lot of major activity either in the form of land hurricanes, which I call himicanes. That's a term I used in my weather book and coined in there. Himicanes are hurricanes over land, and then also the hurricanes, which are the storms, cyclonic storm systems over water. Pretty much nothing going on there, although we have had some solar activity, some good rounds of solar flares and CMEs coming off the sun, but none really directed at Earth. You just remember that from the sun's perspective, Earth is a pretty small target out here. And so when some of these big flares come off of the sun, they're directed in other directions. They're just down or away to hit a strike on Earth. Say you were a pitcher. Say you were a pitcher of a baseball pitcher, and you were throwing at Earth. You'd have to throw a pretty exact strike to hit Earth with a solar flare. But the solar flares do expand out, and we have been hit with these before. So, and I talked about, I believe it was last week, about the big hype NASA trying to gain attention, I would say, attention-getting headlines, I would call it, like a third grader raiding the cookie jar and screaming at the same time to get attention. That's about what NASA was doing. And then they had to admit that there's really a low probability of Earth really being hit by one of these mega flares that would take out our communication and power systems, etc. Well, that's all well understood. So one has to wonder why all of the banner headlines when the probability of this happening is no greater now than it was yesterday or than it will be tomorrow. But I think they're just looking for funding, because if there's nothing major going on, then, gee, maybe they don't need funding. Just like Noah had to predict this big round of amazing hurricanes for the 2010 season, I think because they're looking for funding. Basically, that's my view of it. But this week there will be more of the same, as far as we can tell, at least for the next few days. The sun has been relatively mild, but active, as par for the course, I would say, for moving into the next solar cycle. So basically, we have seen some solar activity, but nothing to write home about at this point. There's a couple storms in the Pacific right now, but no named storms of any type in the Atlantic or Caribbean at this time, or Gulf of Mexico, any of those typical hurricane locations. This is something that was suggested by a friend listener, and it's becoming apparent that someone might try to blow up a nuclear bomb in that Gulf oil well that's spewing tremendous amounts of oil into the environment. It's just an absolute worldwide natural disaster, not natural disaster, man-made disaster. But if they try to blow up a nuclear device in there, then all of that radioactivity, a lot of it could end up in the atmosphere. And that could eventually end up in your water system. So the question is, how could you deal with this if you had radiation or from any other source, or if you had other forms of pollution? Say there was a volcano that went off and you had volcanic ash. How would you deal with this? How would you filter water to get clean water? And the answer is that there is a very simple pre-filter that you can build, and I know many people out there have already have their Dalton water filters, but you wouldn't want to put radioactive or volcanic ash laden water into your filter, because that's you would want to pre-filter it. So I'm going to quickly describe how to make, out of just things you have around your household already, a pre-filter in case of, say, nuclear fallout, volcanic ash, any other kind of major pollution. Say that we've had this before, where China or Africa, the Sahara, would have these tremendous dust storms, and those dust clouds would actually reach all the way to the United States. So how would you get rid of this dirt, volcanic fallout, nuclear fallout, whatever? It's all the same solution. You would take a bucket, any bucket, 5 gallon would work best, but any bucket, punch a number of holes in the bottom of the bucket, put a t-shirt or cotton cloth, cotton seems to work best, and just line the bottom of the pail, or just line the pail with an old sheet, whatever, and then put dirt, black dirt, into the bucket. So the reason for the cotton t-shirt or cloth, sheet or whatever you have, is to stop the dirt from flowing out of the bucket. So basically what the dirt is doing, it's grabbing onto and filtering out this particulate matter, volcanic ash, nuclear fallout. Nuclear waste or fallout wants to grab onto something, and that dirt is a perfect capture or material for nuclear waste. So, and also for any other type of cloudy dust, whatever. So that would be a pre-filter, and then you take that water, and if it still has some dirt in it, you could then run it through another piece of cloth to just get the dirt out, and then a second filter maybe below the bucket, but then that water you would put into your Dalton water filter and filter as normal. So basically, you take for the pre-filter, you take an average bucket, punch some holes in the bottom, put a cloth, a sheet, or t-shirt in it, put some black dirt in there. Not clay. Clay and sand are not going to work well. Basically, you want a black-type dirt, the type that you would use in your garden, and filter out that particulate matter. As I said, volcanic ash, nuclear fallout, dust from foreign dust clouds or whatever you have, that particulate matter, then you can put that water into your water filter and safely then complete the water filtering process as normal. At any rate, on to the next topic. Just a quick update on the oil spill in the Gulf. It continues. They continue to muddle around down there. The only solution is to harvest the oil. And the reason the oil companies do not want to do it is because of the vast, absolutely vast amount of oil coming out of that particular well. I've heard that the oil pressures in that tube are extremely high, much higher, 20 to 50 times higher than a normal oil well. And so there's simply no way you're going to cap that or do anything with that oil well other than harvest the oil. But if they do, it's going to turn out to be an economic disaster for the oil industry because of the sheer volume of oil. And I would estimate that there's an ocean of oil down there. So this is going to keep going on for a very long time. And it would almost be like we must find a location to put this oil. Maybe in underground caverns, but to take this oil and move it so that it's not polluting the Gulf anymore. But as I said, it would become obvious to everyone in the world that there is a vast amount of oil down there. No such thing as peak oil. We're seeing extreme vast amounts of oil coming out of this oil well. And so if we were to continue to use oil, which we really shouldn't, then we should tap this oil and use it. Convert it to usable forms and use this oil. But that's not going to happen. And there's something I said a very long time ago. I did an analysis on oil, and this was based on known oil reserves at that time. I took the Canadian sand oil fields, I took the tar fields in Venezuela, in the Orinoco flow area of Venezuela, and I took the oil reserves in the Mideast, and just took those three areas and said, if you burned all of that oil, you would consume all of the oxygen in the atmosphere. So it's pretty clear we cannot burn all that oil. We cannot continue on a path of using oil as energy. We need oil for lubrication and machinery. We need oil for many, many products that are made out of oil byproducts, everything from plastics to all types of chemicals. But the point is, we do not need oil as a main source of energy. In other words, gasoline and for automobiles or trucks. There's amazing amount of free electrical energy, and it's only because of the greed and the self-fulfilling interests of the oil industry barons and who have a control of the governments that we do not have electrical power, free electrical power, and that should have been here since the beginning of the 1900s. At any rate, so that's just a small review of the oil spill. What a complete worldwide disaster. I'm amazed that other countries have not gotten on the U.S. more, but it's very clear that the leadership in this country, the leadership in industry, totally incapable of dealing with any type of crisis. But as I said on a show a number of weeks ago, I gave the solution. It's very simple. You get the shipping industry to build an upside-down funnel. You put it over the spill area, the leak area, if you want to call it that. And then you put a tube to the surface, and that oil will push its way to the surface. And then you just line the boats up and start filling the boats up. And you would be filling them up at an amazing rate. And as I said, you would soon learn that the vast amount of oil there is going to go on for a long time. So we would cut out all other oil sources, the Mideast, other Gulf oil wells, etc., and that would literally ruin the oil industry. Oh, what a shame. Wouldn't we all hate to see those poor people in the oil industry have to go out and get a real job? Okay, on to the main science topic. There's a question that comes up here. Was there a Big Bang? Everybody's heard about the Big Bang. Supposedly, the universe began in one colossal explosion, and all matter, everything in the universe came flying out. And to make this happen, the laws of the universe had to reverse for a flash in just the right way. Some of the most bizarre stories, just fairy tale science. And so once we've got measuring devices out into outer space to measure the supposed remnants of the Big Bang, contradictions began to arise faster than answers were achieved. So then they had to invent dark matter and dark energy and string theory. Now there's a thing called brain theory in which we might have 10 parallel universes. It's getting so bizarre, the stories are getting so bizarre because the original stories didn't make sense. Instead of coming back to reality and saying, well, gee, this bizarre physics stuff isn't working, then they went off farther into left field, farther out beyond left field, if you want to call it that, and began with even more bizarre theories. Dark matter, for example, actually has been around for a very long time. When I was at Cornell in the late 1970s, early 1981, there were groups of astrophysicists there that were working on a concept called the missing mass. And that's just another word for dark matter. And at the time, at that time, late 1970s, there was a problem with galactic theory. The idea behind a galaxy, you know what a galaxy looks like, it's that spiral arms with a big central core. Well, the problem was when they measured what are known as light curves, in other words, the red shifts and the blue shifts coming from the arms as they moved around the central nucleus, they didn't make sense. And so they had to invent what is known as a missing mass. There had to be some kind of missing mass in out in the structure of the galaxy, in some kind of a ring, to allow the orbital velocities to be correct to match the actual data. The only problem was that after this bizarre addition of missing mass, the galactic structure would look like this. You'd have a small central core with most of the mass, which you can't see, orbiting the small central core, and then all of the stars in the spiral arms orbiting all of this. So it was a bizarre structural problem in physics to begin with. It could not possibly have been true. And even if it formed once, it would have to form exactly the same way in billions of galaxies all over the universe. So what's wrong with this? It just was a theory that made no sense, but you couldn't talk with these professors, with these scientists. I often pointed this out to people that, you know, this couldn't possibly be true. Statistically, it couldn't be true that you would have more matter orbiting, more matter that you couldn't see. So you're projecting that this matter is there, but you can't see it. And it would be orbiting a nucleus much smaller than the sum total of the mass, the missing mass. Just a problem that absolutely was went against all reason and logic and physics. Because in physics, in celestial mechanics, you have smaller things orbiting bigger things, not bigger things orbiting smaller things. It just did not make any sense. And especially to have very organized amounts of big matter orbiting little things in some kind of a ring. It just defies logic. And even to people out there, just average people, you would see that this absolutely defies logic. Everything we see in a gravitational world, the little things orbit the big things. And so anyway, those concepts remain to this day, which is very bizarre. So ever all along, I've been saying the Big Bang didn't happen. It's a bizarre set of theories. And it really resulted from initial work by a guy named Hubble. He was the first guy to have a good telescope, one in which you could see galaxies. But before the early 1900s, they weren't aware of these galactic structures, of which our sun is one star in the Milky Way galaxy. We now know that, but back then, that was a new, phenomenon to realize that there were these immense billions of stars in a single structure, and it had this amazing spiral shape. So at any rate, as Hubble, having one of the first telescopes, as he looked out at these galaxies, and he was able to take the spectral, the light spectrum of these galaxies, he tabulated and noted that the vast majority gave a redshift. And at the time, special relativity was coming into vogue. It was being well accepted, proven in the laboratory. So it made sense at that time to say, these galaxies are all moving away from us. Everything is departing, it's expanding, and we're in the middle of this void of expanding galaxies, so therefore the entire universe must be expanding. And then if you reverse that thought, if it all contracted, then potentially it could contract back to a single point, thusly the Big Bang. And that's where the Big Bang had its initial birth, in the concepts of Hubble, and that's why the Hubble Space Telescope is named as such, because it's named after Hubble, who originated the Big Bang idea. But these ideas have been around, of course, since that time, and now 110 years approximately. So they are well ingrained in cosmology, the basis for trying to understand what's going on out there, what's really going on in the universe. So there was a series of experiments, I believe they were in the 1960s, where Bell Lab scientists and other related to military experiments, but they were trying to bounce signals off of artificial satellites and then measure those signals. It was just a natural evolution of attempting to understand technology before the space age or during the space age, and understanding how transmissions work in outer space. So they then noticed that there was all of this other noise coming from everywhere else. So this is the point I'm trying to get to. This past week, there was an announcement that X-rays have been discovered in all types of locations around the solar system, and there's somewhat of a X-ray noise, especially around objects like comets and planets. But if you look at the real data, there are very strange situations with X-rays, and that's what I'll be talking about here. But the point is that in the latest set of observations, they see that X-rays exist in our upper atmosphere, a very fine, faint kind of spray of X-rays. These X-rays are just another form of light, just like visible light, like our eyes see, but much higher energy. And it turns out that our atmosphere, this is a very important point, that our atmosphere is opaque to X-rays. In other words, it absorbs X-rays. So we don't get that blast of X-rays from the sun. In a big solar flare, we can get X-ray activity, and that's one of the dangers also of X-ray or of solar flaring, is that we would get a blast of X-rays, which could cause cancer rates to increase. During some of the very heavy solar flaring over the in the last solar cycle, Russia, in fact, was doing statistical studies on patients, hoping that in the future they would get some idea of if there was a trend around a certain time for people to develop cancer based on solar X-ray activity, and that X-ray activity coming down, actually getting through, enough of it getting through the opaque atmosphere to actually affect Earthlings. But be that as it may, when you look up, you do see X-rays in the upper atmosphere. So if you were outside of the Earth, that would somewhat give you a picture of the atmosphere. It would give you a way of observing our atmosphere and the densities in the atmosphere and many other properties if you could look at the upper atmosphere of the Earth in X-rays. So back to the initial point that I was trying to make, what would the Earth look like in X-rays? What would the universe look like? So if we were looking out from Earth, we would just see kind of a maybe a faint haze of X-rays around Earth, and that would be about all. We would see the X-rays that are absorbed up there, and some of the residual from that would get down to observation points on the surface of the Earth. But to really see X-rays, you would like to get out of the atmosphere, up above the atmosphere of the Earth with satellites. Then you could look around, and that's where there are many satellites right now looking in X-rays, looking at the universe. So what do they see? Well, there were some surprises. Saturn, Jupiter, for example, exhibit X-rays, but interestingly enough, little Saturn, well, Saturn isn't so little, but it's much smaller than Jupiter, but Saturn is 50 times more active in X-rays than would be accounted for by just solar reflected X-rays. Now understand, the sun is putting out X-rays, they'll hit a planet like Jupiter, or they'll hit the Earth's upper atmosphere, and then some of them are reflected, some of them cause secondary X-rays, but you would see this X-ray activity based on solar X-rays hitting an object and then observing at a distance from a satellite. But Saturn, interestingly enough, puts out about 50 times the amount of solar X-ray activity than you would expect from simply reflected X-rays. So what's going on with Saturn? Saturn's rings have X-rays. Very interesting. I was at the scientific meeting a number of years ago where that was announced. And so very interesting, but then scientists go, well, we don't really know what's going on, but then they come up with the idea that, oh, it's just solar wind interacting with some small property of the rings in Saturn, for example, and not realizing that the properties of the universe are partly electrical. And that's where all of these activities, remember when the Voyager spacecraft first went by Saturn, and observed rings or spokes in the rings of Saturn. And that's something I had predicted in one of my papers, that these electrical comet-like activities would be observable once you get close to Saturn and the Saturn ring system. So at any rate, they were discovered, they were observed. But now there's a tremendous amount more data. For example, comets, all comets. Now, a comet is supposed to be a little ice ball out in outer space. It's supposed to melt, or it's not really a melting process. It's a sublimation process where the ice goes directly to a vapor form. It's called sublimation. And so that's supposedly what's going on with the comet, with the dirty snowball comet model, which is still maintained in spite of the fact it couldn't possibly be true. But as my very early understanding of a comet, I said it's an electrical discharge of the solar capacitor. The one thing that will separate this model from the dirty snowball comet model is to show that there are X-rays far to the sunward side of the comet nucleus, something that should never, ever possibly happen with a dirty snowball comet model. So lo and behold, 1996, by accident, the first comet X-rays were discovered, guess where? Far to the sunward side of the nucleus. Well, isn't that interesting? Because planets don't necessarily have that. They're out there, they're much bigger, they're much more active than comets. Why would a comet show a spike type activity, a sunward spike activity in X-rays? This is an ice ball. There shouldn't be any X-rays on a comet at all. Maybe a little bit of surface X-ray activity, but certainly nothing that would cause X-rays 30 or 50 or 100,000 miles out away from that icy nucleus, or alleged icy nucleus. And so what exactly could be causing that? Well, if you look at the fact that a comet is not an ice ball, that it's discharging the solar capacitor, and that coming in from the solar side is a very tight bundle of high-energy electrons, now you have a source for that X-ray activity that you would then observe. Okay, well, so if the planets are discharging the solar capacitor, if all of these other objects are discharging the solar capacitor, then one might expect a plethora, abundance of X-rays around planets and other objects in the solar system. But as in the case with Saturn, Saturn is a small active star. It has fusion in its atmosphere. There again, one of the standard theories says that an object in space has to be very large and that gravitational collapse in the atmosphere of this object is what kicks off fusion, and that fusion in our sun occurs in the core. Well, once you realize that Saturn is undergoing fusion, you realize that that model could not possibly be true. There has to be something else going on. Saturn exhibits very much sun-like fusion activity. It has a solar wind coming off of it, so does Jupiter, but Saturn is much more active than Jupiter, but it's smaller. None of these things make any sense. Another example, when one of the Voyager spacecraft was going by Saturn, there's a oscillator which sends the signal. It's the carrier wave signal, radio signal, that carries the data back to Earth, and it's based on an oscillator, an electronic device, and it's an oscillator called a Marconi oscillator. And it's a very exact frequency, so that the receiver on Earth, tuned to that same frequency, can pick up and receive the data. In spite of noise and other activity in outer space, it's looking for the data on that one very set frequency. So as the Voyager spacecraft approached Saturn, it had a drop in the frequency, which the only possible reason for that would be due to electrical effects of the planet Saturn. And that gets rather complicated, so I'm not going to go into the details of that. But there again, Saturn had a much bigger dip in its frequency on the Marconi oscillator than did Jupiter. Jupiter's much bigger, should be much more powerful. Why did Saturn, a much smaller planet, or star, if you will, why would it have a much bigger change in the Marconi oscillator frequency? Well, electrical effects. And that's something that I pointed out way back then, and it's still a case of data being swept under the rug by the standard science industry. And I call it an industry because it's a business. Let's just face it. It's a business. But now let me get back to this concept that if you looked up from the surface of the Earth, you would see a faint fluorescence of X-rays around the entire outer atmosphere of Earth. And so if you tried to detect X-rays from the surface of the Earth, and you tried to look out and see X-ray activity, you would have to somehow subtract all of that Earth atmosphere activity, if subtract that away. It would be like trying to look at stars in the daytime. Our atmosphere is blue. We look up and see a blue sky. That's because light is reflected off the chemical elements in the atmosphere, and it makes the sky look blue, but it causes a lot of light to come at your eye, and it's noise in a sense, and does not allow you to see the stars during the daytime. So the point is that looking out in X-rays, you would see a very similar situation. You would see a brightness in the atmosphere of X-rays. So you have to get out beyond it. And then, now here's the point. When scientists originally went into outer space, they took sensitive, very cold detectors, and they started looking in all directions. These were space-borne detectors. They were in outer space, away from Earth's atmosphere. And they looked all around. They saw a microwave background radiation, a 3-degree Kelvin. This is very, very cold stuff. Your detector has to be much colder than 3 degrees Kelvin, just a little bit above absolute zero. So these are very difficult detectors to build. And the mirror, for example, the reflector that would gather this radiation had to be very cold. Very difficult device to build and maintain, but put in outer space. They looked around and they saw in all directions a relatively even, somewhat blotchy, but still relatively even, 3-degree microwave background radiation, and they said, this proves the Big Bang. This is what we were looking at. But now, remember, one of the things that I had predicted a long time ago and was just discovered. You know, a couple weeks ago I announced it on my show that all stars, including our own, or the vast majority of stars, have a nebular cloud surrounding them. And that's what I have been saying all along, is the source of that 3-degree microwave background radiation, that little hiss of noise that is detectable in all directions. So just like we would have to get away from Earth's surface up into outer space, so we're not looking through this haze of X-rays in the atmosphere to see the microwave background radiation of the universe, we have to get outside of this nebular cloud that surrounds the sun. And until we get outside of that and make measurements regarding the microwave background radiation of the universe, not of the nebular cloud in which we are engulfed, in which we are enshrouded, then there's no way that scientists can say that that is due to the universe and therefore the Big Bang. Now, it's just a matter of scale. Once again, we can't look at objects and get a good X-ray reading on objects in outer space until we get out of Earth's atmosphere, because Earth's atmosphere is opaque to X-rays. It blocks most X-rays, and some of them we can see from below the atmosphere, but it causes a brightness in X-rays and causes us to see just a very distorted view. So basically, we have to get above Earth's atmosphere to see the universe in X-rays, to see Saturn, to see the Jupiter, to see Saturn's rings, to see the X-rays on the nose side of comets, etc., etc. So likewise, we would have to get a spacecraft or series of spacecrafts well outside of the donut nebular cloud. That's something I predicted had to be there because it was one of the sources of material for comet tails. but it's also the other side of the capacitor. That's the other side of the solar capacitor, the battery that drives our solar system electrically. It had to have that big cloud out there, and it has been discovered. And also, it would be bright in microwaves. So therefore, you cannot see the universe in microwaves until you get outside of that cloud, if you understand what I'm saying. And when you get outside of that cloud, you're going to find that the rest of the universe is pretty dark, pretty void of microwave background radiation. And so basically, the Big Bang cosmologists were blowing their horn far too early, because now there is proof of the concept that I put forward long time ago, that the solar system was surrounded, the sun was surrounded with this nebular cloud. It has been discovered, and it would put out a microwave low, kind of a hum, so to speak. It would put out a noise or a light in microwaves. And so therefore, that's what they are seeing. And when we see other stars with that nebular cloud surrounding them, then you see the blotchiness. You see exactly what is being measured by these spacecraft. When they think they're looking at the residual of the Big Bang, they're not. They're looking at the haze, the light, the microwave background radiation coming from this hazy cloud that surrounds our sun, which is very much a part of the electrical nature of our sun. And that's what discharges when we see the discharge through a comet. That's what causes the X-rays on the sunward side of comets, the discharge of that solar capacitor. All of this makes perfect sense. So one has to wonder, why do cosmologists, why do scientists, why do astrophysicists continue down this course of absolute nonsensical physics? As I said, instead of going from the Big Bang, and once they realize that all kinds of data are absolutely in contradiction to this, instead of coming back to reality and saying, well, the universe is just steady state, there's no reason to believe that it's expanding or doing anything strange. No, they go farther out into left field and say something more ridiculous, like, well, maybe there's 10 dimensions, or let's invent dark matter. 99% of the matter in the universe we can't see, we can't detect, but we know it's there because it has to be there, because our Big Bang theory isn't correct unless it is there. So they have to invent another more ridiculous concept to patch up the one that didn't work in the first place. And now they're going on to string theory, bubble theory, and one, as I said, more bizarre than all, brain theory, in which there are parallel universes. All of these are wonderful thoughts. They're wonderful thoughts, but we're dealing with science, not Mother Goose nursery rhymes. And so this is the problem. Mainstream science has gone off into Mother Goose nursery rhyme land, and they can't come back. It's really a major problem. It's a problem in getting equipment and funding. It's a problem with dealing with anything rational in science today. But you have to understand one thing, and this is something that it's very difficult for many people to grasp. Many people can understand that the Big Bang is ridiculous, and they just have a feeling that, yeah, this is ridiculous, it's goofy, it doesn't make any sense. But it's more difficult for many people to understand the concept that there is a great need for bad science. There is a tremendous need in the world of leadership in the world for bad science, because this keeps the public off in left field. If real science were taught in the textbooks from grade school on up, a few very self-evident things would come to pass. For example, that we don't need oil. We don't need oil at all. We have sufficient electrical energy in the universe to drive all of our needs, and therefore we don't need, there's the situation, many things go together in this world. Oil, banking, irresponsible governments that do not cater to the people but cater to big business, because there would not be a major oil industry. The energy industry would be, once you set it up, it would be self-running. It would need some maintenance from time to time, but you wouldn't have major industries requiring energy. The houses could be heated much more efficiently with energy, and more than likely, more people would live in energy-efficient living situations. The biggest problem today with the economic model that is used in the Western Hemisphere is that it cannot continue, because it demands the constant resupplying of resources, of trees, of materials, of metals. And all of this then requires energy to move it. The food industry has become absolutely insane. And if you lived in a universe where people understood basic, real scientific principles, they would typically want to live in an environment where probably most of their food came within a mile of where they lived. Most of the energy would be local. It would be provided by local energy sources, that and the energy requirement would go down. We pay an incredible amount of energy cost simply in transporting things. It's probably not well known, but a large percentage of the oil that comes in a tanker is a large percentage of that oil is used to move the oil. That the oil coming from the Mideast or from other locations, there's a lot of money made in shipping it here. And so the point is that the economy that is set up today, the model that is set up today in the world, is based on very bad science. I talked about when the BP oil spill occurred, or the breach in that oil well, that this is the idea of fossil fuels is absolutely impossible. Absolutely impossible. Where were the dinosaur bones or the fern forests that caused oil to become locked 18,000 feet below the seafloor and pressurized to the point where it's 50 to 70,000 pounds per square inch of pressure? How did this get down there from the dinosaurs in the fern forest? Well, it's absolutely ludicrous. There again, bad science, but nobody wants to talk about that, because it opens up as a bigger can of worms than the oil spill itself. How did that oil get down there? Maybe it comes from comets that pass by the Earth, and the Earth has been layered many, many times. Maybe the Earth had oceans down there. Maybe the Earth has had cycles of life that have been completely destroyed and layered over, and the life cycle that we're existing in right now might be hundreds of millions of years old. But that's just one cycle. It could be wiped out in any second. And if it could be wiped out in any second by incoming celestial objects, objects that pass by the Earth but don't necessarily hit it, that, gee, why would one live the way we're living today? We're living today in a world, the Western model, as if there is no end in sight, that everything's going to continue. You notice when Obama was asked to comment just the other day on the oil situation, what did he say? Totally, totally out of touch with reality. He said, everything's going to be good. Everything, we're going to clean it up, and it's going to be better than what it was like before the spill. What an idiot. How completely out of touch with reality is this person that's sitting in the White House? And if you look at prior presidents, they would be similarly out of touch. No clue. The scientific community recommends blowing a hole in the floor of the ocean with an idea of closing it up. As one friend said, you don't blow things closed, you blow them open. So the idea of taking a nuclear bomb into that cavern, into that pipe, and blowing it up is the most absurd thing in the world. You're going to release the pressure. You're going to allow more oil to flow up and cause a bigger disaster. Absolutely insane, but this is what is coming out of standard science. I was talking about x-rays. Okay, let's go back to x-rays and the vision of the world in x-rays. X-rays have been discovered above thunderstorms. So instead of realizing what's really going on, that the energy for that thunderstorm is coming from above, instead of saying that, scientists say, no, the x-rays are shooting up out of the clouds. Absolutely, absolutely ludicrous, because the clouds do not generate enough energy to cause x-rays, let alone to have them shooting out of the cloud up above. So once again, and this is something I see repeatedly with bad science, is they have it absolutely backwards. Instead of the energy coming in from outside, as it has to be, to power the thunderstorm, and therefore the x-rays above the thunderstorm are caused by this same flow of energy, they have an absolutely ridiculous scenario where a thunderstorm cloud shoots x-rays up towards the sky. Absolutely ridiculous, because the natural energy flow from a thunderstorm cloud is downwards towards the Earth. That's the closest sink of energy to the thunderstorm in the clouds. But once again, literally everything today in standard science, the major theories are absolutely backwards. And what does this cause? This causes a very backwards view of the human race, because the biggest event that has shaped the human race in recent history was a similar event where Venus the comet came through the solar system, ravaged Mars, took away its atmosphere and ocean. That's a great example of a planet that will rebuild someday, that was completely devastated by the passing comet. The same comet that passed by Earth, but we had a vast pollution event here. Oil, brimstone, great flooding, and that is the major event that has shaped human history, but is denied by standard science, as if it never happened. I've mentioned this before. I have a friend that taught history, world history, in the major school systems in southern Florida. And I opened up one of the history books. I went back to the beginning, looking through the history book, and this is the history book that is used throughout the state of Florida in public schools. I said to this teacher, where's the part about the Great Flood? The response was, we don't teach that. That's mythology. That's fairy tales. We don't teach that in these schools, as if to say we teach correct science. And there, right there, you have the most important event in human history, the most important shaping event in human history, which goes along with the idea that comets are not dirty snowballs, that comets can be large, they're not always small, they can come in from outside objects outside the solar system, and if you see one of these objects coming in, it's going to look like a vast comet, not a big orange ball. So you have groups running around that are actually promoting bad science and then rewarding scientists for producing and maintaining bad science. And it starts with the Big Bang. It continues with the idea that the solar system started all at one time 4.5 billion years ago. You hear scientists repeating these like nursery rhymes. You hear them, scientists, repeating this absolutely ridiculous dogma as if it's some kind of a religion, and then you find out that that's really what it is. It's more like a religion, because very simply, that's how they earn their paychecks. If they say those things in the right order, they get paid. If they say anything else, they're not going to get paid. Very simple equation. So when Obama and Bush before him increased the national science budget, it was just a way of putting a bigger ring in the noses of the 99.9% of all scientists and engineers who work for the government. You're not going to get better science. You're not going to get more science. You're just going to get more of the same, more entrenched, more monopolized by the same group of people. So, at any rate, it's very important to understand that if you look out into the real universe in X-rays, what you're seeing is the result of a very electrical universe that's a term that I coined back in the early days. It's in my early papers where I called the result of all of this electrical universe, because that's exactly what it is. The result of a gravitational universe with a good smattering of electrical activity joined in. And you have to understand that the electrical activity does not necessarily affect, and it very, very rarely affects, the motion of the planets, because they're big, they're gravitationally bound, and only under very extreme electrical conditions are you going to see any type of change at all. But they are mainly mechanical also. For example, the comet tail that is attracted electrically to the nucleus causes a drag on the nucleus, thusly changing its orbit. So these are very subtle concepts, not for the weak at heart or the many people running around the internet who try and be scientists but aren't. There are very subtle concepts here. They have to be presented correctly to the public. And if you understand these, then you understand that X-rays, yes, are a natural part of the environment in outer space. And yes, there's a good reason why Saturn has more electrical and X-ray activity than a bigger planet, Jupiter. There's a lot of good reasons for this. Saturn is a younger, more active star. It has a higher level of fusion in its atmosphere, etc., etc. So there's nothing counterintuitive when you understand electricity has a role in the universe, but it is not the dominant force. Gravity still holds everything together. Gravity is what holds the galaxies together. The galaxies form in a gravitational world, but electrical activity is very apparent. When you look at last week, I talked about the new discovery where they've discovered comets moving around the central galactic regions. Well, there again, if the comet is a discharge of a solar capacitor, the galactic nucleus is the source of that solar wind, then naturally you should expect comets in that region, in the region around the galactic nucleus. And therefore you see them. And as I said, the other stars just the other day were detected with X-ray signatures surrounding them. All of this a very natural byproduct of that condition. Let me quick give the mail order address. I've just got a couple seconds left. It's P.O. Box, it's JMCC P.O. Box 58, Navarre, N-A-V-A-R-R-E, Minnesota 55392. Just remember the Dalton water filter with four water filter elements, free Kato WRX 911 shortwave radio, and free shipping to the 50 states, $289. That's normally $319. It's $289. And get your water filter. And also, remember I described earlier how to build your pre-filter using a bucket with cloth and dirt in case of other natural or man-made disasters. This is Jim McCanny. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.